Cancer, diabetes, even obesity, do their roots lie in toxic stresses on our kids?
We're really talking about fear that is experienced very early in life, chronically, and then held in the body over time without repair.
That's Robin Carr Morse. She says chronic fear is at the root of many of the diseases we attribute to genetics or aging. We talked to her about her book, Scared Sick. And are we shortchanging ourselves and our loved ones when we're afraid to have that conversation?
When you're talking about death and dying, it's tough, but actually it's an empowering discussion to have, and it leads to dignity and respect of personal values. Because the key to some of this is the simple completing of a form called an advance directive.
That's Dan Morheim. He'll tell us how to take better control of the end of our lives. His book is The Better End. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Riana. New research shows that stress early in life can cause serious diseases like diabetes and heart disease when we're much older. One emerging cause has yet to make it onto the radar screens of most Americans: the impact of chronic fear on the very young. By releasing stress hormones into the body, fear seems to set the stage for later illness. In her book, Scared Sick, family therapist Robin Carr Morse looks at how psychology, neurobiology, the immune system, and genetics interact to make us vulnerable to chronic stresses, not only in early childhood, but even in the womb. Robin Carr Morse is the former director of parents training for the Oregon Child Welfare System. She practices family therapy in Portland, Oregon. Robin Carr Morse, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Scared Sick, I have to say, had me scared sick. It was very fascinating to read and also painful to read, because one realizes what an epidemic there is in this country, in the society at this time, of fear, most particularly among children. What kind of a problem is this, and what is the greatest issue it is around?
Well, we're really talking about fear that is experienced early, very early in life, chronically, and then held in the body over time without repair. And the reality is that that experience on a chronic basis is at the root of many of the diseases that we're dismissing as being genetic or as the inevitable results of aging. These diseases are not getting better in our culture. Our health outcomes in our nation are terrifying. We have one of the shortest life expectancies of any industrialized nation. We lag behind more than 20 other countries. Nearly half of us have high blood pressure, have high cholesterol or diabetes. 1 in 8 has at least 2 of these. 1 in 33 has all 3 of them. A third of all deaths in our nation are due to heart disease or stroke. When we turn then to emotional health, I can go on with our rates of diabetes are outrageous. The new data says that at our current rate of diabetes, 1 in 3 children born 5 years ago will develop diabetes in their lifetime. The physical health outcomes are terrifying. But so are the mental health outcomes. At this point, 25% of adults over 18 in our country suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder in a given year. 18% of us suffer from an anxiety disorder. Almost 10% of us have a substance abuse disorder. And 1 in 5 of us have a near relative that has been addicted to alcohol or drugs. So our outcomes are poor and are getting worse. And the question is, what's going on? You mentioned fear. But what we're talking about here in Scared Sick is fear that happens to babies in the first 1,000 days of life.
You know, the big question I had going into this book, it's very difficult to tease out one cause versus another. I mean, we could say that obesity, you know, there are people who talk to other environmental causes like chemicals, obesogens, mm-hmm. in our environment. the sedentary lifestyle and smoking and other lifestyle causes of heart disease. Other people point to our toxic diet in terms and implicating that in terms of Alzheimer's. These are all complicate the picture a bit, don't they?
I think you're absolutely right, but I think that in almost all health outcomes, there are multiple strands that contribute to it. I think that each of the things that you have mentioned are also true. The reality is, however, that we've been overlooking a major one, Francesca, something that we can do something about in our culture. I mean, it's a hugely unrecognized contributor to disease, and it's something that by just a bit of awareness, we can make huge changes in those outcomes. So I think you're right. There are other contributors, but let's get rid of one that is so obvious and the research is so strong, particularly since we have had PET and SPECT and MRI, a way to look at the brain, a way to look more deeply into the body and see this incredible connection between the brain, the immune, and the endocrine system. When we're frightened, fear comes in to the brain through the senses, hits the amygdala in the brain. The brain, the hypothalamus in the brain, sends an immediate message to the pituitary and to the adrenal glands, which are the endocrine and immune systems. So that chronic stimulation, fear, negative emotion, will dysregulate either of those systems or both. So we now can see some things that we can do. And Scared Sick talks in quite a bit of detail about little traumas for babies. You know, we don't realize that a brand new nervous system is susceptible, is vulnerable to experiencing things as traumatic that we would take for granted or overlook.
You've talked a bit now about some of the ways, the physiological ways this happens. Talk a little bit about the fight or flight syndrome. How does chronic stress break down the regulatory system, the endocrine system? And that, the endocrine system is the one that has a lot to do with regulating weight and things of that kind. Is that right?
And diabetes, yes, it does. The issue is that when fear is experienced in the brain, as I said, it comes through sort of the alarm system. And then the hypothalamus in the brain in fight-flight, the fight-flight system involves the HPA axis. So it's the relationship between the hypothalamus in the brain, the pituitary gland, and the adrenal gland. The pituitary is the main gland, endocrine gland, and the adrenals, of course, sit on top of both of the kidneys and regulate things like inflammation and the immune response. So when we experience fear, it's a life-saving reality, fight, flight. Immediately, the message goes from the hypothalamus to the adrenal glands, which increases heart rate, increases respiration, really gets the body ready for fight or flight. It also signals the endocrine system, which is designed really, cortisol, there are two primary hormones that are involved in this process. One is adrenaline, one is cortisol. Adrenaline is meant to mobilize the system, and cortisol is meant to demobilize the system. So these two hormones in circulation under normal circumstances do just what they're supposed to do. They will allow us to mount that immediate threat and then calm down from that immediate threat. But when our fear system, our HPA axis, fight, flight, are chronically stimulated, those two hormones circulating constantly can become dysregulated and very much affect the functions of the adrenal glands or of the pituitary, the immune or endocrine system.
What are the statistics around trauma, around abuse, around, and even maybe some things that don't make it onto the statistics that may be sources for chronic stress for children in this culture?
Well, I think it's important to realize, Francesca, that child abuse is obviously a terrifying reality in our country, and neglect is equivalently destructive to little brains early in life. But we're talking in this book not just about what happens to children who are abused or neglected. You know, the reality is that when babies are gestating in a highly stressed mommy, for example, the hormones that she's experiencing, the stress hormones, the same ones I just mentioned, adrenaline and cortisol, that are circulating in her body in response to fight flight, are also bathing that little brain and body of the fetus. Then if the baby is born prematurely, prematurity is a huge contributor to infant trauma, that nervous system is totally unprepared for life outside the womb. They go usually into a NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, which is, again, life-saving for a baby, but it is also true that that little nervous system is not ready for touch, let alone for light and sound and so on outside the womb. Babies in the NICU experience 10 to 15 events of pain each day that they're there. Traumatic birthing practices, you know, we have seen way too much use for convenience of practices like C-sections and inductions. Again, any one of these, Francesca, alone is not going to by itself set off disease. It's when they occur chronically or there's a series. When that baby, for example, goes home from the NICU to a stable and loving family, that trauma can be healed by wonderful nurture. The problem is that so many preemies don't go home to that kind of a home. They go home to maybe a teen mommy or a highly stressed family, a parent or mother who is drug abusing, maybe maternally depressed. Of all the things that surprise me in the research, I'm a family therapist. I work with people every day, but what surprised me the most was the impact of maternal depression. Maternal depression has almost as deleterious an effect on the brain and body of a baby as does child abuse and neglect, because what it does is disavail the mother from being there with the baby emotionally, joyful, interacting, reciprocal, eye contact, soothing sounds, and so forth with the baby are the basis for attachment. When attachment is interrupted, this is trauma for a baby. Other routine kinds of things that we see that are traumatic for babies that people dismiss because it's a very little child, they think, oh, well, Bill, he's too young. He'll get over it. He won't remember. But domestic violence, divorce, custody and visitation arrangements that are insensitive to the child's developmental needs, many medical procedures and practices, these are things that cross all class and ethnic lines that we need to look strongly at in our culture to reduce the rate of trauma and subsequent ill health.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Robin Carr-Morse about how chronic fear in childhood causes disease later in life. Her book is Scared Sick: The Role of Childhood Trauma in Adult Disease. One of the things you say in the book is, you know, when children's brains are growing, if they miss something that they needed, you've missed the boat. You can't get it back. And yet you
not
also...
always. Not always. It depends on what. Certainly we talk about empathy in that way. We talk about certain skills, emotional skills. But that's not true of everything, Francesca.
Well, say a little bit more about that. I mean, I have heard, the kids growing up in abusive homes, if they can find one person who can give them the nurture and validation that they need, be that a teacher or a friend, that's something that can help them overcome these problems. But it seems like it's going to take a lot more than that.
Well, I think that one of the best studies we've had looking at the issue that you now are talking about are the studies that are based on the lives of the Romanian orphans that were left after Ceausescu left power. Many of these little ones were basically just warehoused in orphanages, and the nurses early in the process, no longer, by the way, but historically, were told not to get attached to the children. So there was no singing, there was no holding, there was no comforting. And what they found with the children was that in the absence of that kind of stimulation early in life, that these little ones often could not attach to another person. Their bodies withered, many of them. Many of them, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the photographs, but they show photographs of children who are now 18 or 20, and they look like they're 7 or 8, tiny little shrunken legs and so on. I mean, development really is dependent upon touch and human contact. So the issue that you're talking about is a matter, again, of how often does it happen and at what point in life. But of all the things that makes a difference in terms of our health and well-being, the attachment relationship early in life and on an ongoing basis as well, the emotional connections between that baby and someone who thinks that that baby hung the moon, are very key to that child's learning and behavior and health.
So talk a little bit now about what is being done and what can be done. I mean, obviously many of these families where abuse and neglect is going on are not even open to intervention, especially if they stay under the radar. So what needs to be done?
I don't know that that's true. I think that if you, I mean, I was director of parent training for the child welfare system here in Oregon. Before that, I was director of pre-parenting training and took that into 32 other states. I think that people are not wanting to let someone into their homes if they feel they're targeted or if they feel like someone's snooping or it's the government or something like that. But actually, if it's done in a non-targeted, universal way and resources are made available, most people, particularly when they're pregnant or have a newborn, are feeling pretty vulnerable and pretty open to support from someone that they view as a nurturer, like a nurse. The nurse-family partnership is a very good example of a highly successful preventive program. And again, they use nurses to go into high-risk homes. They have a pretty good rate of retention and success in engaging these families. And they get started prenatally. They can reduce the rate of smoking of the mommy and hopefully reduce it or get rid of it altogether. They can increase birth weight. I mean, they work with people before the baby's born to optimize the health of the mother and the baby. And then they work with them for the first couple of years of life to optimize her understanding of what the baby's cues mean, how to best develop that attachment relationship through reading the baby's needs correctly and responding with warmth and so on. So as well as health measures, you know, making sure that nutrition and again, smoking and domestic violence and those kinds of conditions are, if they're present, are referred for outside help. So there's a great deal we can do. We can do a great deal just by training doctors to talk to people about their history, their emotional history. I mean, how many doctors do you know who ask you anything about your prenatal or early life history or your emotional history in general? But this is how they first picked up on these correlations through the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, Kaiser Permanente study done with several thousand people, looked at correlating the middle-aged health outcomes of their Kaiser patients with a history of their childhood. And they asked them to fill out a questionnaire on adverse childhood experiences, which gave us some of the first correlative information about early adverse experiences and adult health outcomes. But this was a very unusual doctor, Dr. Vince Felitti in San Diego, and he recognized the importance of histories. Most of us, when we go to the doctor, you know, we get an exam, we get some lab work. There isn't nearly the emphasis on histories, and particularly on a conversation that's relational and emotional in nature about what went before, not just on the medical record, but what our life experience has been. We can do a great deal by working with insurers to have them begin to pay for some of the things that prevent this problem, like maternal depression. We need wide screening for maternal depression, prenatal and postnatal, and we need to treat it right away before it shapes a little brain chemically and structurally. We can do a great deal with pre-parenting training, getting to young people, juniors and seniors in high school, having them learn something about relationships between men and women, boys and girls, or whoever their partner is going to be, what kind of hard work that is, how to handle anger. And then the reality of babies. The pre-parenting program that I ran in Oregon had kids 3 days doing a mental health-based group work in the classroom and 2 days a week in child care working with babies and toddlers. That reality is the best birth control method I know of. you know, just imagine that in our culture, as easily as you could schedule a haircut or a workout, you could stop by a warm, friendly-looking place, looks more like a Starbucks than a clinic, and meet with a well-trained, emotionally savvy individual to talk about individual problems with your child or children. The approach of the individual who is the helper would not be a one-size-fits-all situation, but getting to know that parent, that child, and tailoring what they recommend for that individual child and family. 45 minutes when you needed it, whether it's a tantruming two-year-old or a sixth grader who's just come home from school saying she hates school, she's fat, she's ugly and won't come out of her room. I mean, these are things that we can work with all along the line that reduce this reality of fear and trauma in the brain and body.
The book is Scared Sick, and we're talking with author and family therapist Robin Carr Morse. Well, you are laying out some wonderful programs for prevention and intervention at an early age. What happens with kids who have in their teens or people who are adults? Can they go back and correct what was lost? Can they help their brain to heal?
Absolutely. Everyone can help their brain to heal. And again, the key is relationship. Therapy is widely touted. I'm a therapist, so I'm part of that party. I think that therapy is fabulous if there's a strong sense of trust between the patient and the therapist. If not, keep looking. In terms of specific trauma therapy, some of the new therapies target the brain, and recognizing that trauma is fear frozen in the midbrain, some of these therapies are very specifically targeting bilateral stimulation of the brain, which, for reasons I can't explain, frees up trauma, and fairly, relatively simply and nurturingly. So the person is talking about the trauma, and they're receiving either EMDR, eye movement, desensitization and reintegration therapy, which involves just watching the therapist's finger or another moving object from left to right. Or some therapists are using sensory motor reintegrative work, which is the therapist is really watching for signs of traumatic behavior and works with the patient when they see these little movements. It could be an eye movement, it could be a twitch, it could be a tone of voice, and they work with them right there in that place to change the frozenness of the experience. Cognitive behavioral therapy has shown great effectiveness with trauma, but for so many people, therapy doesn't have to happen in a therapist's office. I mean, I've seen children who've been raised with a lot of trauma in the ghetto in many cities in our country. And, you know, dance for children is fabulous. If you look back at how human beings have survived trauma through the centuries, you realize that we've engaged as tribes in ritual. So drumming and dancing and movement, exercise, meditation are forms of therapy that one can invest in relatively inexpensively and very effectively.
Well, Robin Carr Morse, your book goes into this on a very deep level, both socially and biologically. It's Scared Sick, the role of childhood trauma in adult disease. Thanks so much for talking with us about this.
You're
very
welcome.
Important thing.
Thank you, Francesca.
Robin Carr Morse is a family therapist in Portland, Oregon. Next up, how can we have a better end? We talk with Maryland State Legislator, Dr. and author Dan Morheim. Stay tuned for more of Writer's Voice and check out our free podcast at writersvoice.net.
I'd sing more about more of this land, but all God's children ain't free. I'd open up every door I can, 'cause all God's children ain't free. I met a beaten, broken man. He shovels dirt, but got no land, and he held out his hand to me. All God's children ain't free. I'd sing along to a silly song, but all God's children ain't free. I'm gonna sing a blues for the man they done wrong, 'cause all God's children ain't free. Mister, how about the man you condemned to die by taking everything that he's living by and reject him from society? All God's children ain't free, no. Reject him from society. All God's children ain't free. I'd be happy walking any street, but all God's children ain't free. I'd have a smile for all I meet, but all God's children ain't free. I'd whistle down the road, but it wouldn't feel right. I'd hear somebody crying out at night from a sharecropper shack or penitentiary. All God's children ain't free.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Most Americans would prefer to die at home, surrounded by loved ones. But 56% of us die in the hospital, many hooked up to tubes that snake into our veins and lungs, assaulted by heroic measures that just prolong our deaths. It's a horrible way to die, but it doesn't have to be this way, not if we prepare. All it takes is telling our doctors and families how we want to be treated at the end and writing it down in advance directives. But few Americans do. Dan Morheim wants to change that. A doctor and delegate to the Maryland State Legislature, he'd like to see public policy support more individual control over the end of life. But he also wants to help individuals directly. His book, The Better End, shows readers how to keep decisions in their own hands and spare their families the trauma of guessing about their end-of-life wishes. You're both a doctor and a Maryland state legislator. How did you get interested in this subject, not just as a medical person, but as someone who's a public servant?
This subject comes up, first of all, obviously in my clinical practice and in everybody's life. Actually, we don't get to talk about that very much, but who isn't affected by somebody, friend or family, who's sick? But it comes up also in the legislature as we cope with how to deal with end-of-life care issues, with medical expenses, with all sorts of things.
And why is this such a big issue right now? What's been happening?
Several things have been happening. First, you just have to look at the demographics. The baby boom generation, people between 45 and 65, are now a huge segment of the population. And for them, the first time now, they're really confronting managing medical crisis and end-of-life care for their parents' generation, and for themselves. And so there's just a lot of people, and they're going to consume a lot of health care services and a lot of health care dollars. But secondly, this generation also has been one that had a tendency to want to change things. For example, many years ago, it was the same generation that changed on the other end of life how babies were born. Up to that point, the stereotype, if I may, was that the mother was whisked into the operating room as if she were a sick person. The baby was pulled out and taken away from the mother, wrapped in a blanket, and the father was shown where his baby was in a bassinet through a glass wall. People wanted the advantages of the technology and the safety that that seemed to provide, but they didn't like being cut off from the birth experience. And so there was a change. And so basically we have family-centered birth experiences. But now as we confront the other common life experience, that is the end of life, people want the best of medical care, they want the advantages of technology, and folks are surviving diseases and injuries and illnesses that they didn't used to survive. But as they come to the end, they don't want to be cut off from family and friends. People don't want to end up in intensive care unit, really getting care that's closer to a pummeling or torture even in some cases. They don't want to end up in intensive care unit cut off, hooked up to tubes and machinery long after any hope of meaningful recovery. So there's really a change afoot. And this book, The Better End, is really my attempt to start that discussion and get people to take a realistic look at this whole issue in a way that we've never had before, because this is really the first time in human history that we likely have, or most of us likely have, some say in how we die. And that's a very powerful concept.
And yet it seems so often that we don't have a say in the way that we die. More people die now in hospitals. I mean, I think by far, you point out in your book, The Better End, and we seem to have lost control just at the time when we are going to really need to have more control over this, because we are living longer.
This is a challenging topic, obviously, and it's hard to be upbeat about end-of-life care. I mean, I also face that in my political life. I go to community meetings, and people say, what are you working on, Delegate Moorheim? And I say, well, among other things, end-of-life care, be sure to vote for me in the next election. You know, when you're talking about death and dying, it's tough, but actually it's an empowering discussion to have, and it leads to dignity and a respect of personal values. Because the key to some of this is the simple completing of a form called an advance directive. I'm also on the faculty at the Hopkins School of Public Health, and we studied how many Marylanders, and then we extended to how many Americans have completed advance directives, or also known as a living will. And they're free and legal in every state. They've been around for 20 years, and only it turns out only about a third of us have. Yet clearly 100% of us are going to die. And by the way, 20% of Americans die suddenly. 80% of us are going to die over some lingering illness. So completing advance directive, having these discussions among family members and with physician and clergy, whoever advises you, is actually a very empowering step to take. And once you do it, you put that paperwork aside and you hope it doesn't become necessary. But if it is, it's there. And that's how you take control of that.
You know, I've heard in terms of the advance directives and the do not resuscitate orders that often these advance directives don't work. They don't work in the ambulance. Doctors ignore them in hospitals. What is your experience with this?
That happens far too often. And part of it is an interesting phenomenon that when we get to end-of-life care issues, not only does it come up as a great source of anxiety for the patient and their family, but health professionals who otherwise are pretty cool and pretty rational, making very complicated and important decisions about health care, when it comes to end of life, there's a tendency for us, and I'm speaking of myself too as a 30-plus year frontline clinical practitioner in emergency medicine, to kind of lose our ability to think rationally because it's such a powerful human emotion to think about death. So part of the situation is that so few Americans have completed advance directives that healthcare practitioners don't see them often enough. And in a clinical practice, when you're not seeing something very often, you're not really sure what to do when confronted with it. And so one of the steps that goes back to individual responsibility, if more of us would complete advance directives, healthcare practitioners would see them more often, and it would become the norm, not the exception. Because it's the exception now, or the unusual thing, healthcare practitioners don't always recognize them as well as they should. Although, there's a change underway. People are in paramedics at the beginning when they're called and so forth. They're beginning to recognize this more and more. But it's given the demographics, this is going to become the common thread of how end-of-life care is approached. Not the rare thing, it's the common thing.
But
we have a way to go on changing everybody's attitudes. That's part of the discussion that Americans, as a culture, we've avoided. And now it's time to step up and have that discussion and confront it realistically. We're very fortunate. People are surviving things they didn't used to survive. When I started in medical practice, emergency medicine, a big urban hospital level 2 trauma center a long time ago, It was very rare to see a 70 or 80-year-old patient even. Now that's the norm. When there's a 100-year-old patient in the emergency room, we used to run over and look at that person. Now it's commonplace. So it's a completely different world that we're in, and the goal of the Better End is to get people to, you know, be aware of this new reality and take control according to their own values.
And the book is The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. Well, this is a discussion that I've actually had with my own mother, who is 91 and is facing significant end-of-life challenges, although we don't know when she's going to go, and she's a pretty tough lady. She's got some major chronic illnesses. And we ran into a problem when we were talking about advanced directives, because when you get down to the nitty-gritty, I think this is natural. She's natural that we can all understand this. You know, she doesn't want to go before her time, but she doesn't want to suffer when it is her time to go. So how do you know the difference?
In every case, it's really an individual decision based on their medical circumstances as well as the person's personal values. Sometimes you can tell when people are approaching death. They clearly are disengaging from life. They're not communicating. Somebody with advanced dementia, it's easier to see. Often a sign is people stop eating. That's a pretty basic thing. Or you know that their diagnosis is so advanced. They've got cancer that's spread everywhere, including the major organs in the brain. You can tell that those people are clearly approaching the end, and you want to provide comfort and dignity in the last days, weeks, months of life. But it's not always easy to tell, and that's why some degree of advanced planning and discussion is important. Sounds like you and your mother have had a conversation, and so while you can't anticipate the specifics, when that time comes, you'll know, and you'll have a good sense of what your mother would want. And so when she can't make decisions for herself, the assumption, the hope, is that you'll be able to do it for her in a way that was consistent with her values.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dan Morheim. He's a Maryland state legislator and a doctor. His book is The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. Now, you talk in this book, The Better End, about some different approaches to advanced directives. One of them is the five wishes. Tell us a little bit about what one should look for in finding a form that helps you do an advanced directive.
So you can get forms from any state attorney general. Five Wishes is a form that is available on the internet. If you're of a specific religion, there are forms that fit Jewish, Catholic, Muslim. But you can also, and this is an interesting thing, you can write your own advanced directive or build on a form and then add things that you might want to particularly have recognized. So you don't have to follow the form exactly. And so a form can be very fluid. Also, it's something you may change over time. When you're 18 years old, and I gave my wife and I gave our daughter, when she was 18, an advanced directive form. And she said, Dad, when I was 16, I checked organ donation on my driver's license. But what she does when she's 18 is different when she's 28 or 38 or 58 or 88. And so it's something that you should reflect on from time to time and update. My wish is that it becomes as routine is paying taxes or paying your car insurance or keeping your driver's license up to date. These are things that we all do as a matter of course. But this is one that we haven't done, and I think you can do it pretty easily. It takes a little time to think about it, but actually the forms are very short, 3 or 4, 8 pages maybe, and mainly check boxes, and you can fill them out in a few minutes, really. An advanced directive is really three parts. One part is the kind of care that you want when you can't make decisions. So you sort of have three choices. Please do everything possible to keep me going as long as possible. And then on the other end of the spectrum is, you know, please stop care, you know, pretty quickly. But most Americans, and me too, choose the middle path, which is keep me going for as long as possible, as long as I'm comfortable. And what I have specifically in mind is as long as I'm not suffering with intractable pain, and as long as my mental functioning is going, I'd like to be kept alive. But if I've really lost mental function, I don't want to be kept going. I would allow natural death to take place. So if in that circumstance I got a bad case of pneumonia and I was unable to think or was in intractable pain, unable to think not just because of the immediate illness, but in general, then, you know, let nature take its course. On the other hand, sometimes you can put things in an advance directive that says, I don't want somebody involved in my end-of-life decision. Let's say you have three children, and one of them you really don't have faith in their judgment. You can say, please leave that person out of the decision-making process. So it's actually, you can tailor the form to your own circumstances. I also, in mind, specify that there's certain kinds of music I'd like played when I'm around and seeking comfort, certain, you know, kinds of movies that I like to watch, and to have those available as well.
That's lovely. You tell us about a couple of cases, some of them quite cautionary. Tell us about Alberta.
Alberta Cole is representative of a kind of patient that I have taken care of on many occasions, and most people in healthcare are familiar with, an elderly patient who is living alone after her husband has passed, who undergoes a series of very serious medical illnesses and along the way becomes demented and incompetent. And basically think of a 90-year-old patient that I sometimes see in the emergency room who's been in and out of nursing homes, basically living there, who's had advanced Alzheimer's, not been aware of surroundings for a long time, not communicative, stays in bed, gets bed sores, which is a breakdown of the skin in pressure points, is fed by a tube going into the stomach. Personal hygiene is taken care of by diapers and tubes. And that's their existence. And then they have some episode and come to the emergency room, and we put them through a series of procedures that might keep them alive for another day or two or week or two or month or two. And we know, all the healthcare practitioners know, that this is really a pretty futile effort. It's painful. Sometimes if they have not designated a no CPR, no cardiopulmonary resuscitation, their heart stops beating, we attempt to start the heart going, sometimes successfully. But what that involves, and most people have seen this on TV, is pushing on the chest wall, pushing on the sternum with your hands. And what you feel underneath your hand is all the ribs break at the sternum. And then it's crunch, crunch every push. And then we put tubes in the windpipe and to start large IVs puncturing into the neck or the chest or the groin in order to get more fluids or medicine into the person. It's pretty much of an ordeal. And that happens all too commonly. And you have to ask yourself, to what end is that happening? And I actually have carried with me some real guilt over having been a participant in these kinds of procedures. At the same time, I understand that in today's medical world, I have to carry out these things because there's no one who's been designated to make a decision in the absence of the patient who can no longer make decisions, and no indication as to what that person wants. As a clinician, I feel it's my job to provide accurate information and respect patients' wishes. Sometimes they choose what I would like them to do. Sometimes they don't. But I respect their individual wishes. And the approach of the book really is largely stories, Alberta Cole being one that is too common, but indicates something that happens really every day in every hospital in the United States. And I think when people read that story, they'll be a little upset, but they'll also realize the truth of it and say, is this what I really want for myself or my loved one?
Yeah.
But then there are other stories that are a little more friendlier, shall we say. And in between the stories, I have practical advice, because what I'm really about with the book is to get people to do the practical step of completing these forms. It's just not that hard, and it's free.
We're speaking with Dan Morheim. His book is The Better End. It's about how to take more control over your own end-of-life decisions, and it's really a useful, detailed book, incredibly helpful. It has been for me, although I haven't yet done my own advanced directives, and it's prompting me to do that. Now, one of the things you also talk about, and I think you've already referenced it, and that is palliative care. We know about hospice, you know, end of life, and palliative care. I've heard that these two things are connected with each other, but not necessarily the same. Could you talk about both palliative care and hospice?
They overlap, but they are separate. Hospice care means care when it's determined that the person has less than 6 months to live. And hospice is a facility that's staffed with physicians, pharmacists, nurses, and others. hospice care could be rendered at a facility or can be rendered at home. And the hospice staff works with the patient, their family, to make sure they're comfortable. They also can teach families skills, how to administer medicines, things like that, so the person is kept comfortable and may die at home or may die in the hospice as opposed to in the hospital or the intensive care unit. Palliative care really refers to limiting pain and suffering. Now, you could conceivably say that palliative care is if I treat somebody with a broken arm and give them some adequate pain medicines along with a splint and a sling, that's palliative care, and that's true. But it's generally reserved for more severe pain cases. And there was a really interesting study in the New England Journal of Medicine recently because it highlighted how we should change our thinking about palliative care. It's been thought of as something, and too often by physicians and others, as, well, let's give the person palliative care. It's like throwing in the towel. You know, we're all done, nothing more to do, so let's let the person get palliative care. In this study, they had people with lung cancer, and they divided them into two groups, those who got palliative care early and those who got palliative care later. And what they found was the folks who got palliative care early lived longer, had much more productive and happier lives, and also they spent less money on health care. So it's almost impossible to have a discussion about health care today without talking about money. But in this case, a little expensive palliative care saved money over the long haul. The people lived longer and were more satisfied with their care. So palliative care really is something that is needs more understanding and appreciation by patients and by healthcare practitioners.
And so what we mean by that is that somebody is not going to go the route of chemotherapy, radiation, a surgery. They're going to basically get pain management and then go about their lives. Is that
or
right?
Or even during those phases of chemotherapy, radiation, even with that, you get palliative care. It becomes much better for the patient. There's a little bit of a tendency in healthcare, and I think everybody's experienced this, where I'll use doctors as the example. When we're so specialized now and so technical, that when, say, the neurosurgeon is done with what their procedure is, they sign off the case. Or when the gastroenterologist is finished, they sign off the case. There's nothing more to offer within that specialty. But nobody really understands the holistic part of the patient. And so part of palliative care is to provide that. You know, just because the technical part of the job may be over for a specialist doesn't mean that the care for the patient should stop or that people feel there's nothing more that can be done. There's actually a lot that can be done, and not only make people comfortable, but keep them, you know, enjoying life, connected with their families, often still going to work, and being productive.
Now, doesn't that run head-on against the whole move to control pain medication? More, it's getting more and more difficult to even get pain medication prescribed by a doctor in places where it's clearly needed.
It's another one of those complex difficulties we face in the United States today where we have kind of a double standard. We want people to get relief of pain, and yet we're fearful of prescribing opiates, narcotics, or strong pain medicines. When somebody's approaching the last few years of life, really, there are a couple of things to say about pain medicine. One, the chances of them becoming addicted are really nil or certainly irrelevant. And secondly, if pain is properly managed with pain medicines, the person really doesn't become addicted. It's completely different from, say, a heroin addict who's shooting up. And I've worked in inner city hospitals, so I'm quite familiar with how that type of drug use operates. I'd also like to see, as some states have done, begin to incorporate medical marijuana as appropriate for pain relief and for relief of other symptoms. It's, you know, it's another medicine. It's got its problems and its side effects, but it's really quite safe. Certainly compared to the other medicines that we use, and that's something that needs to be more fully explored and expanded.
You also talk in this book, The Better End, about selecting a healthcare agent, and you spoke before how we can deselect healthcare agents. We can say we don't want to have somebody making decisions about us. What are the kinds of things, the conversations we want to have with people that we might like to choose?
Part of all this is the cultural taboo of communication, or breaking down the barriers to communication on this topic. And I think of other things that we now take for granted or have come to accept that we used to maybe hide more. You used to not be able to talk about, women could not talk about having breast cancer. And now as we begin to approach end-of-life care, it's time to talk about it. And so that, a big part of this means choosing a healthcare agent and making sure they understand what you want. And also making sure when you complete the forms that everybody has them. So choosing a healthcare agent, typically it's a spouse. Can be an adult child or a sibling, but it can also be a friend or somebody who you really respect and value. So it's an important decision. You need to sit down, talk with that person about your values. And in the book, The Better End, there are stories of how people make some of those decisions. And then after the story, I actually have some of the forms and guidelines so people can see how that would work. But if you don't choose a healthcare agent, then it becomes a default. Nobody quite knows what you want. Nobody knows who's going to make the decision. And in a healthcare crisis, like I've seen many times in the emergency room, when nobody knows what's going on, chaos tends to ensue. Families fall into strife. And we saw that with the Terri Schiavo case, which reminds me that this is not just for old people. The three most famous cases in American legal history are women under 30. Terri Schiavo suffered a serious brain injury. And at first, her husband and her parents were getting along, but as the time went on, they got onto opposite sides and ended up really destroying that family unit. And I've seen that many times in the emergency room. But the flip side is, sometimes, but not often enough, people are coming in crisis in an advanced directive form and it's clearly been filled out. And actually, it makes it easier for the family and for everybody to do what the right thing is. And it's amazing sometimes to see the strife just sort of disappear and the tension, because it's like when families get together for Thanksgiving. It's fun to see your family members, but there can be a lot of tension. When families are gathered around a medical crisis, it's often the same kind of emotions surface. And when these things have been thought of in advance, it makes it much calmer. It makes a difficult situation more manageable.
We're talking with Dan Morheim. He's a Maryland state legislator and a doctor. His book is The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. You are a legislator in Maryland. We have seen what happened when there was the discussion of the Affordable Care Act, the whole brouhaha over death panels. A manufactured issue, if I ever saw one. Talk about the public policy aspect of this. How are we going to help Americans accept advanced directives, end-of-life planning? How are we going to pay for it? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, this flips over to my life as a legislator. And let's just run some numbers, because you can't talk about anything in healthcare today without talking about money and public policy. So fully 25% of all Medicare dollars, Medicare being the program that provides health care for seniors, is spent on end-of-life care. A significant amount of state budgets, the largest single line item in most state budgets is Medicaid, and a significant amount of that money is also spent on end-of-life care. So as taxpayers, we're paying for it, but we're also paying for it in the private sector, because health care premiums that employers and individuals pay go to commercial health insurance companies, a lot of their expenses are end-of-life care. So we talk about bending the healthcare cost curve from time to time in these discussions and rejiggling the insurance system. But the basic ways that those have been done have been by making it harder for patients to get care, shifting the cost to employers and individuals, and making it harder for providers to get paid. And as a provider, I think providers should be paid for their work. But here's an opportunity to reduce healthcare costs the right way. And there have been a significant number of studies that show when people make these decisions for themselves, and it doesn't mean less care necessarily. It means care according to your value. You can check the box that says do everything possible, keep me going forever, but most people don't choose that. You actually end up saving a significant amount of money. And it's done the right way then, not by the heavy hand of government, not by the heavy hand of insurance companies, not by clergy, not by doctors and nurses, not by ethics committees, but according to individual values. So this is an opportunity for individual action to greatly reshape the whole public policy debate on one important aspect of healthcare, and also to save a lot of money. I agree with you that the death panel discussion was a complete fabrication. There was nothing in there. I read the bill, and there was nothing in there that even came close to that discussion. It did serve to make people panicked and scared and near hysteria, but it also maybe will wake us up to the fact that we still need to have that discussion. So hopefully we'll get there as a society a bit more. In the study we did at Johns Hopkins, when we found that only about a third of people have advanced directives, we discovered a couple of other things. The older, richer, and whiter you were, the more likely, but even there is only 40% of the population. And of course, the flip side, the younger and poorer and the more minority was only about 20%. But we asked people, or maybe even less, but we also asked people, do you want an advance directive? Would you like to have one? And what we found is about 75% to 80% of people did. So there's this huge gap. A third of people have advance directives, but 80% want them. And so how do we go from that 30% to the 80%? One of the things I'm trying to do is just tell people, hey, look, we got to start having this talk. It isn't going to go away. It's where technology is advancing and people are living longer, and that's great. But the end will come, and let's just have that discussion, bring it out into the sunlight. And when we do that, we'll be better off as a culture, we'll be better off as individuals, and we'll be better off as a health enterprise as well.
Now, I just want to ask you a very kind of practical question.
Sure.
Once you have one, where do you keep it? Who do you give it to? How does it function?
When you have one, you should be sure to make sure your healthcare agent has one, your attorney, your doctor, your hospital. But of course, you could be traveling or someplace else where it's not available. So when I travel, I actually make a little copy of mine and I keep it with me. Eventually, with electronic health records and information on chips and credit cards, it'll be much more easily obtainable by appropriate people. But for the time being, the best thing to do is keep it with your important papers and make sure the people around you have a copy. You know, one other thing about advanced directives, of course, is the patient can't make decisions, someone else does. It's not just about the patient, but it's actually, if you care about your family, we say we do, we say we love our loved ones and the people near us, it's really as much or more for them than it is actually for ourselves personally. And, you know, the other thing is it may sound a little bit like it's grim or scary, and of course it is, but once you take this first step, you'll feel a lot better. It's actually a way to actually get a little bit upbeat about otherwise something that's so difficult. You'll feel a lot better when you do it.
Well, the book is, and I highly recommend it, The Better End, Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World. Dan Morhaime, thanks so much for talking with us about this vitally important subject, planning the ends of our lives so that we can be comfortable. Dan Morhaime is a Maryland state legislator and doctor. He's on the faculty at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.